Hey there. My name's Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table's a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is an edited version of something that we call the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with the hope that it can be a positive catalyst and encouragement to you in your own explorations. In our experience, exploring what we believe can sometimes be hard work, and we don't think anybody should have to do that alone. We're able to offer this because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond a local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. Just a quick word about the title that I gave this Talky Bit in the blurb, which was Why Everybody Needs a Resurrection Story. I hope it's obvious, but just in case it isn't, there's some hyperbole in that sentence. Don't get all literal on me now. That would be a mistake in terms of interpreting that. Of course, not everybody needs a resurrection story. But I hope that by the time we're done this exploration, I will have at least invited you to consider the idea that resurrection stories as a category speak to some very common human needs to such a degree that even if we don't call them that in our own experience, most of us have one, and some of us have lots of them. Some of us have several. Now, that to even imagine that might require a redefinition of resurrection story, right? So let's just get into that. So today is, in the Christian tradition and in much of the world that's deeply influenced by that tradition, often identified as Easter Sunday. Could also be the March long or April long weekend, I guess, depending which day you're thinking of. But it's a day that in lots of calendars is designated to mark the part of that tradition's belief that Jesus, the central figure in the stories on which that religion is based, rose from the dead. He was resurrected. And the stories we grow up around get lodged in us pretty deep. And in that process, we often experience, either implicitly or explicitly, the notion that they should stay deeply embedded in our beliefs and our practices, in our psyches, because they are true. So we're often, one way or another, we're often exposed to that combination of ideas. And I'm not going to get into the weeds of all the things we might mean by a word like true, except to say that it's a potent idea, and one that sometimes takes a fair bit of effort to examine should our journey take us down that path. In any case, if we grew up around any version, almost any version, of Christianity, or a culture that's informed by that tradition, we've probably got some ideas about resurrection pretty woven into us. And at the very least, we probably know or have a sense that we know what it means. It means to come back from the dead, or slightly more indirectly, to come back to life. So in terms of the word itself, those are both legitimate ways to think about what resurrection means. Now, what I want to do this morning is give us a quick tour of some other resurrection stories. And the reason I want to do that is that I want to invite us to consider this question. Why are there so many of these? And why do they often have so much in common? It's kind of interesting. This is going to be a bit of a whirlwind tour. So if you're either in the room or if you're listening later to the podcast and you feel like I missed some important feature or a nuance of a story that you hold dear, then you've got my advance apologies. And of course, if you grew up aware of some of what I'm about to unpack, but were told that the particular resurrection story you were taught is the only one that is true, I also want you to know that you have my empathy. But I'm going to do this anyway. And I'm going to do it in the interest of exploring not just the peripheral beliefs that many of us grew up with, sort of the optional offshoots, but some of the central ones. Because if we're going to explore what we believe, there's got to be some point, I think, here where we don't dodge the center, so to speak. So let's start close to home, in the sense of considering other resurrection stories that exist within the history of the same tradition as the Jesus resurrection story, which is a tradition that many of us share either as personal belief or as influencing us in our own paths in this community. So the Hebrews, and it's easy to forget, but the Jesus story originates as a Hebrew one. It doesn't originate as a Christian one. It kind of got co-opted. But it wasn't a Christian story because there weren't any Christians. It's a Hebrew story. But that came along later. So this is a Hebrew stream of stories that the Jesus story stands in. And that collection of stories has at least three other recorded resurrection stories. in the sacred texts that are collected and sort of affirmed over, you know, the last couple of thousand years. And these are all found, if you care to look them up, in the books of 1 and 2 Kings. In the first of those resurrection stories, the prophet Elijah prays, and a young boy is raised from death. In the second of those, Elisha, I had to remember these on an undergraduate exam, I just had to remember which order the alphabet came in, so I got the prophets in the right chronological order. But anyway, Elisha's second. In the second story, Elisha raises the son of a character called in the story just the woman of Shunem. Let's not get into the fact that she doesn't have a name. Anyway, this is a child. This is kind of interesting in its shape. This is a child whose birth the prophet had also previously foretold. Right? It recognizes a certain story shape here. So that's kind of interesting. And the third recorded resurrection story is a story, this one's just like, for me, growing up where I did culturally, it's just like, what? This is a story about a dead person, dead man's body, who's thrown into Elisha's tomb, and it comes in contact with Elisha's bones, and that's enough. And it comes back to life. So I had to chase that one just a little bit, because I'm like, man, good by degree, like this is getting further and further from a sort of the zap of the divine, isn't it? You know what I mean? Like there's layers here. And they sort of get stranger as they go. So I looked up that one a little bit more. There's some interesting historical scholarship around that last one. It has to do with the belief that in that culture there was a unique power to having people together in the same tomb. So when we tend to think about burial in this culture, we don't tend to think about what constituted tombs then. They were houses for the dead. You could have a bunch of people in there. So kind of like the family plot, but with a roof, you know? And so the idea that if you get enough of the dead family together, you've kind of got this unique intersection with the power of life over death. And so this guy gets, you know, tossed into the wrong tomb, and it's like, woohoo, that works, right? And he's back. In any case, for our purposes, what I think is noteworthy is that the same culture that gave us the Jesus resurrection story preceded that story with these. And so there's a story shape built into the culture that's really significant, and it's very enduring. And lots of those old stories contain many of those same themes as the Jesus story. What's missing, of course, is the notion that the resurrected individual is messianic, is the Messiah. Now, we're not talking today about messianic stories, because there's a bushel basket of those from the time of Jesus. There were messiahs all over the place, or claims, right? And so how do you validate one in the midst of those? That's an important question. We're going to leave that right there. What about other cultures? Because the Hebrew culture / Christian culture does not have a corner on resurrection stories. If you grew up around one of these stories, you may have been told that it was the true one. Why wouldn't you have been? Right? I mean, think about it just for a moment from a distance. Just try to put you in another culture. Of course, it would be the true one. And you might regard it as the central guiding story of your own life. And I think that even if none of us in the room identify that way with these stories that I'm about to share, it's important to know that we probably know someone who might. Right? So just keep that in mind as we consider these. There's an important baseline idea here that all of those Hebrew stories and several of the ones that I'm about to talk about all come from early agrarian cultures. They all are tied to the agricultural cycle. And it's quite a significant feature in terms of commonality. There have been lots of studies that note this. Most of them make the point that the relationship between these stories, including the times of year when they happen, are too numerous to be coincidental. So from the stand back and study them as a group perspective, it's like, no, way too much overlap. It's not an accident that these happen when they do in the cycle of what's going on in the weather and in the world of growing things. We'll come back to that in a bit. So the first one, ancient Mesopotamia. We've talked about ancient Mesopotamia here a little bit lately because we've been talking about justice. And of course, if you grew up in the Christian tradition or even in the Western world, then the Hebrew ideas about justice are important. They still form the foundation of our legal system. And they come from the Mesopotamians via the Hebrews. Right, so there's a long kind of cultural stream of connection here that I'm glossing it for sure, but it shows up over and over again when we study the history of these things. So, Mesopotamia is one of the earliest agrarian cultures. It's one of the first that, from our vantage point, we might think of as the farmers, if you will. The idea of tending to a wider garden
of course, is an idea that's starting to come back into our wider cultural conversation on this continent as we pay attention to the history of indigenous persons on this land, right? The nurturance of a wide place, but the nurturance of something deliberate by way of growing seasons that kept you anchored in a geographic location. That's what I mean when I talk about sort of the first of the farmers. All right, so that's why I'm using that language really deliberately. So these folks, the early Mesopotamians, literally lived and died by the seasons. Winter was grim. It was harsh, it was meager, and spring marked the return of plenty and the ability to sustain life, to stay alive, right? So in that context, here's a little bit about the deities. And some of these stories are pretty great. I'm going to give you the real short version, but if you actually look them up, there's lots of detail. It's quite rich and fascinating. So Ishtar, has anybody seen the movie? It's really, truly horrid to the point where I would recommend it as an instance of...
I saw it just to see how bad it was.
It's pretty great in that regard. One of the leads in that film says of their part in it, into everyone's life, an Ishtar must come. Anyway, I said not too many rabbit trails. Ishtar is the great mother goddess of Mesopotamia, and in that mythology, the source of nature's fertility and abundance. So that's the Ishtar character. And she has a lover, and her lover is Tammuz. He's this handsome young god. The thing about Tammuz is he dies every winter. It's kind of inconvenient. And he goes to the underworld. And his lover, Ishtar, goes there after him to get him back. So for 6 months of the year, she's gone. Because she has to go get Ishtar. Right? Or she has to go get Tammuz, rather. So she's in the realm of the dead, rescuing her lover for 6 months of the year. And during that time when she's away, because she's the goddess of fertility and abundance, the world is robbed of its fertility and its reproduction and its growth. So things die. Because what keeps them alive is gone. Right? And then every spring, there's a goddess of the underworld, very stern character named Allatu. But every spring, she kind of relents, and she allows this imprisoned couple to be sprinkled with what in that mythology is called the water of life. And they return to the world of the living, and they bring life and green vegetation back to the earth. In the Babylonian calendar, because that's Mesopotamia, Babylon, anyway, not to get too tweaky about it, but they overlap geographically and culturally. This gets celebrated in a month that is called the month of Tammuz, which in that part of the world falls in late June, early July. Right, so early, it's kind of just things are starting to grow again. So all across the ancient Near East, other cultures kind of took that story and started to put their own twist on the spring resurrection story. They tweaked the details, they changed the names, but the themes all remained the same. So the Phrygians had this tale of Attis, who is brought back to life on the spring equinox by Cybele, the fertility goddess. The Greeks have the myth of Persephone, who's kidnapped by Hades, but is allowed to return every spring from the underworld to bring back vegetation and grain production. The Hebrews, you may remember, were surrounded by, sometimes dominated by, imprisoned by, intermarried with, intercultured by these cultures. And they often took ideas from them. The story shapes didn't fall out of the sky. They were present in the cultures, right? There's a famous study of this. It remains sort of a benchmark, but it's quite old, 1922. A Scottish anthropologist, a guy named James Fraser. The study's been published as The Golden Bough. And he talks in there, he's a study of world religion and mythology, and he just kind of says, pretty point blank, that the early Christians most likely chose a spring date for Easter, for their resurrection story, to coincide with the existing religious festivals that they were already a part of, to basically match the stories that they already had about their gods. It's really fascinating, if you read the Old Testament, it's easy to forget that the Hebrew people didn't start out as monotheists. Like, it's in the stories. There's lots of gods in the Bible, in the stories. It just evolves to this point where the Hebrews choose this notion of Yahweh, of one, right, as a monotheism. But they don't start there at all. They start here. That's where they're getting their story shapes from. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into as much detail about some of these others, but the overlap of both timing and details is pretty fascinating. So the ancient Egyptians were also dependent on the annual cycles of nature. In this case, the flooding of the Nile. That's what made the Nile Valley fertile. And they had a story about how the god of agriculture, Osiris, gets murdered. This one's really, some of these are wild. He gets murdered and chopped up by his sibling, Set, and his queen, the fertility goddess Isis, gathers up all the bits. True love. Anoints them with oil and all these embalming rituals, which of course Egypt is famous for. This is why the mummies were treated the way the mummies were. She brings them back, not just to life, but to eternal life. He lives forever, right? And so everybody wanted that. And so maybe if they did what the story said, they could have that, which is why we still dig open a tomb and find people embalmed the way they're embalmed. They want this, right? And the story says that's how you get it. So that's how that one happens. In the Norse tradition, listen for the overlaps in this one, because it's not as obvious culturally, but it's pretty fascinating. So in the Norse tradition, the creator god is Odin, and Odin is the central figure. And in this particular part of the mythology, he sacrifices himself. Self-donation, also an important theme in the Hebrew and subsequent Christian stories about sacrifice, by hanging himself on a great tree, piercing his side with a spear. Is this a chicken and egg thing? No, it's actually not, which is kind of intriguing. Like, culturally, these are separate streams. And then forbidding any other gods to come to his aid. You could call down the angels. Nope, right? Anybody recognize the theme? It's there in the story. And he hangs there for 9 days until finally the meaning of mystery of life are revealed to him, and those were held before in the runes in these sacred symbols. So that's the Norse story. I could go on. Like, there's lots of these. What most of them have in common, including the Jesus story, is a link to spring. That's the strongest common theme in all the shapes. And if not directly to spring, then to some other instance of life returning where it appeared to be gone. And there is, it seems to me, in these story shapes, including the Christian one, there's a human desire at work in these. You could describe it as a drive to sort of see over the horizon, you know, to have some way of thinking about, of telling stories that help us think about, help us imagine the mystery of how life can come back when it has been gone, when it has been absent, whether that is literally or more figuratively. There was a news story in the cycle the last couple of weeks about a number of hockey players who were sort of part of a class action suit against a coach who abused them. And I happened to hear part of one of those players' testimony in the court process a couple of weeks ago. And he talked about his mom recognizing the moment when the light of life went out in her son's eyes. Was he dead? No, but the light of life went out. If you had been able to get at these things in that moment, if he had been able to get at these things in that moment, would he have described himself as feeling something other than fully alive? See how slippery the language gets when we talk about death and life, right? So that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about life being absent, whether that's literal or more figurative. When the light of life goes out in someone's eyes and they're still walking around. That too. Not just when we close the box and shovel the dirt on it. For me, and I'm not telling this story so anybody else needs to believe it. Just, I want to be as clear as I can about that. But for me, spring never gets old. I am staggered every year in a new way by how something so frozen, so apparently devoid of life, can come back. I just feel like I'm walking around in a miracle every year. No words. It can come back to life as though it was never dead. And I know we can explain it with science. I'm not naive about that. The seeds go dormant. They're not dead, Tim. They're dormant. I don't know, man. My driveway right now, nothing could grow through that. It feels like it's a sheet of ice this thick. You know what I mean? See what I'm saying? Spring has become, for me, over time, what I would call a thin place. Celtic idea, right? Celts first, then Celtic Christianity. Like these other story shapes, new religious mythology, same story shapes, right? We just stick them in the pot and we stir them together. We get this new thing. So the ancient Celts and following them earliest Christians in that part of the world believed that the world had what they called thin places. And the Celts had this great saying. They liked to say that heaven and earth were 3 feet apart, like all the time, everywhere. So look who's next to you. Anyway, heaven and earth is, you know, about that distance apart, right? 3 feet apart. But there were some places where they were closer. Those were the thin places. And I love that idea. I recently read someone, a contemporary writer, who described thin places, and this is a quote, as locales where the distance between heaven and earth collapse and we're able to catch glimpses of the divine or the transcendent or, as I like to think of it, the infinite whatever. Right? So not a person who's trying to fit this into a particular tidy story shape, but just going, no, I have these experiences in the world where it feels like whatever that mystery is and where I am are pretty close together. And if I just look the right way, if I take it by surprise, or it takes me by surprise, I might get a glimpse of whatever that mystery is, the infinite whatever. For me, that is most consistently spring. Not exclusively. There have been other places, other moments like that, but the anchor has been and continues to be spring. I'll wrap this up with a little story. As some of you know, or you might have surmised, I've been away for a few days. I'm not precious about the talkie bit. I feel responsible for it, and I love it. I love doing it. I love thinking about it, writing it, sharing it. It doesn't happen that often that I'm here and not taking this responsibility. So when somebody else does, it usually means that I'm gone. It was spring break last week, and that gave Corrine and I a chance to get out of town together for a few days, and we chose to spend those days hiking in the desert canyons of southern Utah. Not everyone's idea of a good time, I grant you, but we had a blast exploring these landscapes. The landscapes, for those of you not familiar, and I think most of us at least have a stereotype, one of our adult kids, Kale, when we were talking about where we were, Kale sent a text that reminded us that Bill Watterson, when he decides he needs to draw something alien, he says, I just draw the landscapes of southern Utah because they're weirder than anything I could ever think of. You know, and it's true. You just keep walking around corners and going, I don't even understand how that's there. Never mind how it's balanced, you know, or whatever. So it's a wild landscape. And just to dispel any, you know, notions of a sun-soaked sojourn, although there's nothing wrong with that, we hiked in powder dry sand. We also hiked in snow that was considerably deeper than any snow we've had in Winnipeg for years. So this is not Mexico in the pool exactly. One of those places where we got to hike on this trip was a sort of a famous hike. It's called Angel's Landing. It's in Zion National Park. And I just want to show you a couple of pictures to illustrate this thin place idea here. So Angel's Landing is at the end of a ridge. So that's where the hike goes, is up this spine of this flake of rock. And it's an airy hike. You really are looking off both sides of this thing. And it's about 1,500 feet from the bottom of it to the valley floor to the top, and it just climbs the whole way. It's kind of relentless. So we got to do that hike. And at the top, there's this tree. It's on the top sort of flat rock. And it's alive. You can sort of see that in the left-hand photograph. It has leaves on it. It's an evergreen. It's one of those pines that grow in the desert. The roots that are coming out of it, which you can see in the foreground, are its roots. They kind of look like that. And they just go into the rock. When I think about planting things and growing things in nourishing conditions, I do not think of anything like this. Right? But somehow, over hundreds and hundreds of years, the effort of that has kept that tree alive and helped it to grow, which I think is kind of astonishing. Here's the parallel to thin places. They might, and that's a thin place, they might already exist in the world like that, like spring. But what the wise ones say over and over again in time about the thin places is that we don't tend to encounter them without some effort. In this particular metaphor, the effort's a little bit obvious. It's a 1,500 foot climb. Like, you just got to climb up there if you want to go there, right? That's the effort. But I think when it comes to spiritual things, when it comes to experiencing thin places for ourselves, the effort isn't always that obvious. You know, it doesn't always mean a trudge. Sometimes it's less like the climb in this metaphor, and it's more like the tree. It's more about, instead of trying to climb up to a thin place, it's more about reaching down and in, sometimes into experiences that at first glance don't look like they could have any life in them at all, any more than those roots appear to be going somewhere nourishing. But with time and persistence, sometimes those efforts yield what is needed for us to feel like we ourselves are experiencing new life, new growth. We're coming back to life. And that, as the ancient stories remind us over and over again in so many different forms, is a thin space. That's a place where what we see and know is present right alongside what we can't see and know, right alongside mystery. The sorts of things, experiences, beliefs, ideas for which we use the language of, many of us, the language of the divine. So the question I want to leave us with today, on this day when perhaps we pause to muse about resurrection more than we might otherwise, is where do you find thin places in your life? What are locations or experiences that bring you back to life, that put the light back on if it's dim or has gone out? And if you have such places or experiences, perhaps a day like this is a good day to deliberately pause and take a moment to be grateful for them, to be glad for those places. And if you can't think of what those places are, then perhaps this is a good day to consider what they might be. Because in the end, I think that's what the Easter story is about. It's about this unlikely life that can be found in places where it seems to be gone. So, happy Easter, everyone.